Welcome to Rethinking Youth Ministry, a podcast from the Orange Students team.
Our mission is to help you, the youth leader, influence the next generation.
And we do that through this podcast, other resources, and our weekly curriculum, XP3.
If you'd like to learn more, check out orangestudents.com.
But for now, let's get started with this week's episode.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Rethinking Youth Ministry Podcast. And we are so excited to be joined today by Ashley Johnson and Crystal, a regular with us.
Hey there.
And also Will. It's your first time here with us. And Will is a next-gen pastor in Florida, in West Palm, Florida. And he's done a lot of work on teenagers and learning about how to handle grief and despair in the teenage brain and what we can do to help them. And so, Will, we're so excited that you're here. I'd love for you to share a little bit about what your experience has been in the past year and a half, what you've learned, and what kind of prompted you to move in this direction.
Yeah, so I started a nonprofit because I was seeing this problem, as you know, many of us have.
Like, yeah.
And what do we do about it? And I had so many people in schools, I had parents, educators, that were really kind of scratching their heads, like, how do we help kids when they're facing depression, anxiety, despair? Like, what do we do about it? And so a year and a half ago, I started working with a group of mental health counselors and started talking to people way smarter than me about trying to find some solutions. And so for the last year and a half, we've been doing school assemblies, we've been doing parent trainings, teacher trainings. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And just trying to help bring some solutions to the problem that we're facing.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that. So tell me a little bit about what you found when talking to the mental health professionals. What is the, you know, statistically, what are we looking at with teenagers today versus teenagers 10, 15 years ago, or even further back that makes this a bigger problem?
Well, I mean, we know this. I mean, if we just stop and we look around, like, the behavior of teenagers has changed tremendously.
Right.
I mean, even when we were in high school, like, we used to hang out with friends, like, in physical places, right?
Yeah.
And then now teenagers hang out with their friends in virtual spaces. Like, 40% of teenagers now, they don't hang out daily with their friends.
Okay.
So that's a
big difference.
Big difference. Yeah. And so with that, it's changed how we relate to one another. It's changed how we connect, and ultimately it's caused a major issue. And the issue that we see with this increased detachment and separation from human connection is that we're seeing this rise in despair. We're seeing this rise in depression and anxiety. And, you know, if you really slice it down, you ask the question, well, what caused this? Mm-hmm. It's hard to say, like, one thing specifically caused this rise in despair, but, rather a variety of things. But I would say the one thing, the common thread, is a lack of human connection.
And we're seeing that there's a connection between that and the amount of time that teenagers, or really any of us, are spending on our phones.
Yeah, there's a lot of research that's starting to come out that shows that there is a correlation between the time that we're spending on our phones. What you do in a virtual space, so playing video games or being on social media, you're detaching from your reality of your world.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you guys have ever seen this, but I know I've watched, like, with my kids, like, if they spend, like, let's say 2 hours on an iPad, like, their behavior changes.
Right.
Like, the way that they interact changes. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that with teenagers as well. Like, it's almost like they have to come back to the real world, like, come back to reality. So when you have somebody who's just in a virtual space all the time and they're detached from people, their emotional processing really starts to break down. Empathy starts to break down. And then they just kind of feel numb. They feel stuck. They feel like there's no way out. And I would say the number one problem that this is causing, as every youth worker knows this, is the suicide rate amongst teenagers. It's doubled in the last 10 years. And specifically between the ages of 10 and 14, this study just came out, like, last month, is that the ages between 10 and 14 has grown the most out of all demographics. And it's increased 57% suicide rate in the last 10 years. So as a youth worker, I'm like, looking at this, I'm like, we have to do something about
emergency.
This. Like, this is the fight for this generation, because in the 90s, it was all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right?
I mean,
that's what we were preaching. Just say no, you know, don't
to
do at-risk behavior.
No to everything.
Stay away,
right?
But now, you know, they're not, that's all in, down. Like, it's not as much, you know, sexually active teens is actually down significantly since the early 90s. And so, yes, those things still exist, but the one thing that we're seeing a lot of is a lot of despair. And so we have to do something about it.
I love that you're saying that. And then at the same time, there was something that you said that, I don't know if it felt strange to me, but I think among like my generation, we feel there's a fence between virtual world and reality, and that reality and virtual reality are different places. But for the small group that I lead, for them, it's just their world. And it's all meshed together. There's a girl in our student ministry who I remember talking to her. Her first two boyfriends were in other states, and they never met face to face. And it was a, in her mind, that was a very real relationship. That wasn't like a weird, like cyber world relationship. That was just, it was just a boyfriend.
Yeah.
And so how do we navigate when we understand that there's a difference there, but they don't really feel that way? Is that part of the problem?
Yeah, that is part of the problem. I think it's so interesting that you say that, by the way, because I have a former student who just got married this past year. And he had, you know, he's a very popular kid, so he could have invited many people, but he had to narrow his wedding down to about 100 people. And so of the select people that he invited two friends that he only knew on Facebook or on Xbox Live, rather. So
those relationships are very real.
Very real. And he invites these two guys. The first time they meet face to face is actually at his wedding. But he had such a deep friendship with them. That he's like, I want you guys to be at my wedding.
But that feels to us, that feels like that's a different world. That's a virtual world. Or that's not real.
That
but
feels
to him, it was
foreign
very,
to us. But I think for our students who, they don't remember a time before social media.
Yeah.
They don't remember a time before internet. I don't know that that feels as foreign to them, or that they even see the borders drawn the way that we see them.
Right. Yeah.
So, which makes me ask the question. I've often thought about this question: can intimate, deep relationships be formed in the virtual space?
I think that's the question.
Right.
That is the question. For us, I think it's not possible because we have been wired a certain way to understand relationships and human dynamics a certain way. But think about like kids who are like 8, 10 years old right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They don't know a time without FaceTime. Like,
that's weird.
They can't think of a moment in life where they didn't have the ability to see somebody through a virtual space.
Yeah. But what about physical touch at that point?
Right. So now physical touch is lost, which, you know, and I think that's part of the problem is that we don't understand how certain things are affecting our mental health. And physical touch, as you mentioned, that's a really
big
piece, especially when you start going through a hard time. Like when you're facing despair, it's not enough to have somebody on the other side of the screen. You have to have somebody empathize with you and help you to feel felt, to help you to connect with the emotion. And perhaps that can be done in the virtual space, but if it's only being done in the virtual space, I think we're missing a major piece that actually promotes healing in the brain.
It's interesting. I think our audience probably doesn't know this, but all of us at the table know that you spoke in our staff meeting this morning, which was awesome.
Phenomenal.
And one of the things you were talking about was the importance of eye contact. And I couldn't help but think the number of significant conversations I've had with the girls that I lead over FaceTime and how eye contact is not a real thing. Even on such a sophisticated technology, I'm looking down and they're looking up, and there's never a moment when there's an actual eye contact moment.
So true. Because oftentimes when you're on FaceTime too, you're kind of more looking at yourself.
So true. I was just saying the same thing.
Like true confessions, you know? Like,
just call it out. That's true.
And even when you're not just looking at yourself or looking at the other person, very rarely are you looking in the actual camera, which would be eye contact for,
right.
So you're right. You don't really get eye contact with that.
Okay, so I have a question. So you and I saw each other at the National Youth Workers Convention, which was so much fun. And we spent a lot of time talking to a lot of different youth workers. And it seemed like the dominant conversation around the country was, what do I do about depression and anxiety? And every kid, it seems like, is facing it. And some of it's clinical and medical and honestly beyond the scope of what we can handle as youth workers. But there's this whole other group of kids who are just facing it because that's part of being a teenager now. What do we do about it when it's not clinical and medical and beyond our pay grade?
Yeah. Well, I think one, there's, you know, just to plug one more time, because you can't harp it enough, is, you know, you definitely need to get help, especially when it is clinical, medical, and deeper. But I also want to kind of take the pressure off for youth workers. Like, you don't have to diagnose kids. Like, that's you don't have to figure that out. Because depression isn't the sole cause of suicide. Mm-hmm. Like when we look at the problem, okay, the suicide rates are rising. And we think that, well, this is because of depression. Well, that's not necessarily true. Okay. In fact, mm-hmm. There are a lot of mental health contributors to yep. suicide. Depression isn't the only one. The common thread, though, that every single person who's ever attempted or completed suicide feels is despair. Okay. Despair is mm-hmm. the issue. Well, here's the yeah. good news and the bad news. Everyone faces despair. Mm-hmm. So when we look at despair and we realize that despair is the thing that we have to lean into and help kids to heal mm-hmm. from, then it kind of makes it where we're more empowered again.
Yeah.
Like we're empowered because we can do something to help heal despair. There's mm-hmm. actual tools that God's given us to help kids heal from despair. Like the brain can be reshaped. It can be rewired. And there are ways to bring despair down. Let me explain it, you know, this way. So if you look at the psychology, you know, your brain is made up of two parts. Mm-hmm. Well, your brain is made up of a lot of parts, but two in specific that we're yeah. going to look at. You have the right side of your brain, which mm-hmm. is where your emotional processing uh-huh. takes place. And you have your left side of your brain where your logical processing mm-hmm. predominantly takes place. Uh-huh. What happens in despair, one psychologist explained it this way, is it's like it's a dispairing,
okay.
that the two sides mm-hmm. kind of separate. You have this wow. emotional detachment mm-hmm. and the right side becomes overactivated,
okay.
like a constant drip of cortisol, which is a stress hormone,
yeah. mm-hmm.
over time kind of creates this detachment. And the right side of the brain hmm. becomes overactivated. Your fight or flight mechanisms skyrocket mm-hmm. and logical processing decreases. Mm-hmm. So this is why anytime you've talked to a kid who's facing despair and you've mm-hmm. asked them the question, how are you feeling? Oftentimes the response is, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Right?
Because they're having the emotions, but they can't connect to the part that logically processes the emotions.
Right. Because okay. you need logical processing in order to put things into words. Your okay. word formation happens in the logical side of your okay. brain. So they might say, I feel numb, mm-hmm. right? They don't yeah. even know what they're feeling. So what you have is you have all this emotional energy built up.
Yeah. yeah.
And they need an ability and a way to exhaust that emotion.
Yeah.
They need a way to exhale. And mm-hmm. what this is the coolest part. You ready? So here's what we can do as youth workers. We can help kids heal from despair by helping them to feel felt.
Okay.
That when somebody feels felt, when they feel that somebody understands what they're experiencing
yeah.
through empathy, through love, despair mm-hmm. decreases and the two sides begin to come back together.
Okay. Well, I had a question because even as it pertains to like grief and when you have like a really specific situation that's mm-hmm. happened and talking about this despairing and then trying to help it through human connection, but a teen or a student is just trying to process loss or something mm-hmm. like that. And they use words like, I would try to ask like, well, do you feel like you are seeing in color anymore? And they're like, mm. everything's just gray. Or maybe I will see in color again, but it's dull now. Mm. Or, you know, I guess when you talk about meeting with connection, what tools do you have when you say, okay, this event just happened in your life. Mm. And it's not just something that's internal or just the way you're seeing the world, mm-hmm. but it's like something massive, life-changing happened to mm-hmm. you. And still trying to find connection through
without
that.
Short-circuiting the process.
Like exactly.
Grieving kind of, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. You know, grief in specifically grief, you know, mm-hmm. is unique because you have a high amount of despair, which mm-hmm. means you're going to 100% have a detachment between logical processing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of emotions. They're going to be there and it's going to take time to exhale that. The way that you respond, I think the best way to help someone in that response is to help them to feel felt by using emotional words. Like, so for okay. instance, mm-hmm. you might say, you know, I hate that you're going through what you're going through because mm-hmm. I imagine right now you feel lonely, or I imagine right now you feel
that's good, yeah.
scared. Would you say that you feel exhausted right now? You know, and as you use those words and kind of pitch like, hey, do mm-hmm. you feel this? You feel this? You feel this? Eventually they might say, yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. And the best response is tell me more. Mm-hmm. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
And just allowing them to process and talk. What that does is it allows somebody to feel felt and it really identifies and communicates, I matter.
Mm-hmm.
Like
yeah.
this mm-hmm. moment matters and what I feel matters. And I don't have somebody telling me, well, you know what? God just needed another angel.
Oh, gosh.
No. Oh, that's the worst.
Right. I know.
We have feelings about that.
But then there's the other side of that when they don't want to talk. And what I found is they just want to talk about something. May not be. Is that a helpful tool as well? Just, well, talk to me about your crush then, or talk to me about the sports you like.
Yeah. There is an element of where they might be avoiding feelings, which doesn't mean that they're healing. So that's the one caveat.
Right.
However, timing is everything. Mm-hmm. And don't underestimate the power of presence.
Yeah.
So just being present is huge.
Yeah.
Appropriate physical touch, words of affirmation, and eye contact can help somebody to feel loved and to feel felt even in the midst of their despair.
Wow, that's good.
I feel like I'm learning so much in this conversation because I've been leading small groups for a long time. And I don't know if teenage boys do this. You can tell me. Teenage girls, when they're kind of spinning out emotionally, I feel like they hand me a knot of problems. They're all interrelated and they're all.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, my mom and this boy in school and. And my temptation as the leader is to always sort of pull one string out of a time and logically deal with each of them.
Fix
and
it.
They're not in a logical place at all.
Yeah.
No.
And so just hearing like, oh, you should deal with the emotion before you deal with the logical behavior.
Right. Yeah.
That is really, really helpful.
Yeah.
You have to notice what's happening. Mm-hmm. So if a student is right brain activated, so emotionally responsive.
Right.
To like you, me a lot of the time.
You're right. Yeah, exactly. So when you are emotionally activated, it would be good for someone who's interacting with you to first meet the emotion with emotion. So see the emotion, meet the emotion. So let me give you an example. Let's say that you have a student come in to, you know, youth group and they're frustrated and they're like, I can't believe it. I failed this test and, oh, my teacher is such a jerk and blah, blah, blah. And they're just distraught, right? Maybe they're angry. Maybe they're sad, you know? And maybe it's a senior who's afraid that this is going to affect their college, you know, outcome.
Right.
And, you know, she's crying and she's, you know, she's just really upset. As a small group leader, what you might want to do is you might want to say, well, you know, you did say that you haven't been studying, right? You go into logical processing.
Yeah.
Or, well, what do you think you can do differently to make this different? Because obviously you're in control, right? You go logical processing.
Right.
The problem is that when we meet right brain with left brain, we completely miss them. Like we kind of fly over them.
Yeah.
And then they just hear wah, 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 wah. And meanwhile, they conclude, you don't really care about me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? And you don't care about the situation.
Yeah.
But when we stop and we say, hey, I understand. Oh, that must suck. I am so sorry that you failed that test. And you must feel really disappointed right now. Yeah, I do feel disappointed. Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about it. Right?
Yeah.
And just allowing them to exhale emotion first, then you'll have the opportunity to come back around on the back end and say, hey, what do you think you can do differently? You know?
Well, and it almost seems that when they are allowed to process it out loud, they may be able to draw their own conclusions without us doing it for them. And I think in doing that, they begin to build their own sense of resilience on their own, which would become a tool for fighting despair when it circles back around. So it's kind of helping them process aloud that is enabling them to be more healthy long term, I would think, even though it feels counterintuitive. To acknowledge their emotions feels like you would be condoning what they've done or dwelling on something that feels negative when it's actually the opposite.
My only question to that is, a lot of times when students are processing negative or despair, it comes out in negative emotions.
Yeah.
So when you say meet emotions with emotion, it's like, what in me as the student leader needs to calm down first, because all I'm seeing is anger. All I'm seeing is apathy, or all I'm seeing is this negative response. Mm-hmm. And what mind frame do I need to be in to even have initiate this conversation?
Yeah.
That's a great question, because oftentimes other people's emotional responses can trigger our own issues.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know,
it's good to
and
be
then
aware
all of a sudden,
of.
Like maybe we feel offended on God's behalf, you know?
Right.
And that's really real.
Right. And then we're like, oh, you know, and we feel the need to defend faith or keep them on the straight and narrow.
Yeah.
And we have to take a deep breath in those moments and recognize, okay, they're angry. And they're saying a lot, but if I just sit in this moment with them long enough and allow them to exhaust all this, there's going to be a moment where we're going to be able to turn back. And sometimes you just let it be, and it's the next day kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
But if you have that heightened emotional energy, I mean, we know this. It's just hard to get through anyways.
Right. Yeah.
So you have to meet emotion with emotion. At the very least, you're communicating, I care. Mm-hmm. It sucks that you're in this situation. Sucks that you feel this way. This hurts me. Here's a tool that I like to use is an IFAB tool, which is I feel about because.
Okay.
So using this kind of sentence format with a teenager can help you express your emotions, which then also validates theirs. So for instance, I feel sad about your situation, whatever the situation is, that you failed your test because I can see how it's making you want to give up.
That's good.
Right?
Yeah.
And so you're expressing your emotion and that's showing empathy, really.
Yeah.
You're meeting emotion with emotion. The problem is when we communicate like belief statements and the belief statements kind of, they just discard the emotion.
What do you mean by belief statements?
Yeah.
Like a belief statement, like you're better than this, you know?
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, or you shouldn't feel this way. You know, you have so much to be grateful for. Why aren't you just grateful? Mm. What if you just focused on being grateful?
Yeah.
Well, you know what I mean? Yeah. We're communicating. Those are good things, but it's a belief statement. It's logical processing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we're not meeting the emotion with emotion. It's no different than when somebody faces grief and we all, you know, kind of we're like, oh, we can't say that. It's no different, though, when we're creating these belief statements in a moment of emotional heightency that we have to first say, no, I see this.
Yeah.
Let's be real about what this is.
Yeah.
But as that decreases, that despair decreases, you're going to be able to take them on that journey of health and wholeness.
Okay. And then you talked about journey. So a little insight. So I just lost my dad to Parkinson's about 6 months ago. And what I've learned about grief is that, you know how there's stages. Mm-hmm. There's the, I don't know, the denial, the anger, the acceptance. And so when you're talking about, when you're leading students though, sometimes I feel like as ministry leaders, we want to resolve something so fast. And we treat the stages as truth, but as like a graduation of like, oh, you were in the anger stage, so I'm going to give you all the resources, or your best friend just moved, or you just went to a new school, so this is what you can do. And then we expect them to move on to the next stage of however they're processing despair. But just a little bit more patience that, yeah, you might have had a really great breakthrough conversation with someone and felt that empathy, but that same emotion of anger or whatever may come back in the next day or two.
Yes.
And that patience is okay, especially in the first year of experiencing something traumatic.
The grief isn't necessarily linear. It can be cyclical and you're coming back around to these.
Like a revolving door almost.
Yeah. I bet you can think of a circumstance in the last 6 months where somebody's projected on you where they believe you should be.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And how has that made you feel?
We don't want to talk about my feelings. Yeah, I mean, and I can't imagine at 32 experiencing trauma at 17 to this degree, or a middle schooler trying to navigate hormones, let alone this mountain of pain, and then being able to explain that, and then the pressure of feeling like, well, all my friends just want me to be normal again. They just want me to play and be who I was, and I'm just not yet.
Yeah. No, it feels like that maybe our tendency to want to go logical is just how uncomfortable we can be with despair in anybody, in ourselves, or in somebody else, and just not wanting to acknowledge or experience what is just uncomfortable. Like it just isn't, it doesn't feel good to kind of sit there and stay there, even though that, like you were saying, don't underestimate the power of presence, that being willing to sit there can actually be the most helpful thing that we can do. It's really good.
Yeah. And I would say I'm not by, you know, if you take my Myers-Briggs or my personality traits, I'm not like a, let's just sit around and talk about our feelings. I'm not. Yeah. But what I've learned is that one, the more that I actually identify my own feelings, the more I'm actually able to connect with people and connect with people on a real level. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually able to help people in a very tangible way by first identifying where I'm at and then using that and kind of asking the question, how would I feel if I was in their shoes, right? Empathy.
Yeah.
And then saying, no, I get it.
Yeah. I want to go back. I want to stay there a little bit because I think that's important, that we can't expect to guide students somewhere that we're not necessarily willing to go ourselves. So what can we do as leaders to kind of work on becoming emotionally healthy individuals and leaders to help students then begin to navigate those same emotions?
That's a great question. And there's a lot of different angles that we can go with. I mean, how do we become emotionally healthy individuals ourselves? I think one of the ways is making it a practice, like asking yourself the question, how do I feel? And here's what we do, by the way. We will say thinking words, but use the sentence, I feel.
Oh, interesting. You know? Yeah. Okay.
Like even what you're describing with, you know, some of the girls that you talk to, like, I feel like I'm in a dark place. Like, well, that's more descriptive and it is kind of abstract, but it's really not a feeling word. You know, it's not identifying, I feel this. So there's a tool, you can Google it, called the feelings wheel. Okay. That's helped me tremendously to like actually put words.
We'll probably put that in the show notes if that's helpful.
Even better. Yeah. You don't have to Google it. You can just look at the show notes. So that's helped me to identify, okay, here's what feelings are and here's how to put them into words. And again, putting them into words matters because you're bringing the two sides back together. You're processing emotions, not just allowing them to stay there. And then I'm a big proponent of silence and solitude. Reflection. So we talk about all these like disciplines in the Christian faith. We talk about the importance of worship. We talk about the importance of giving. We talk about serving. We don't talk about a whole lot solitude. We don't talk about silence.
Which Jesus practiced.
Exactly. So I think this is our a lost art, a lost discipline. And it's absolutely necessary for us to heal even ourselves and become whole that we understand the importance of silence and solitude. Okay, I think about this. Okay, here's my last analogy on this. The Apostle Paul should have had a counselor. Right?
Somebody tweet that.
Right. I mean, think about that.
That's the truest statement.
Yeah.
Think about it. If we went through what he went through, I'd be in therapy right now.
Right.
Like that is intense. Like talk about trauma after trauma after trauma.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's got a past, like jacked up, all jacked up. Why didn't he need counseling? And why don't you really see that a whole lot in scripture? Okay, here's my hypothesis. I can't prove it.
Yeah.
But I think when you look at the pace of their life and then you looked at how they lived, they had natural reflection. And I would even make the assumption that they identified their feelings easier and quicker than we're able to do. So Apostle Paul had to go over to the next town, which we would typically drive in our car, you know, maybe 20 minutes. He had to walk there. What is he doing during that time? He's not listening to his iPad. He's not listening to you know, whatever the latest ebook is.
Like
he's listening to this podcast.
He's not listening to this right now.
Where we tell him he needs a counselor.
He's walking, he's thinking, he's reflecting, he's processing, right? There's just this natural rhythm. Then on top of that, they already had, as the model of Jesus showed us, that they actually took intentional time to pray, to be separate, to walk away from the crowd, walk away from the family, walk away from the busyness, walk away from work, and just be still.
So it seems like we've said that human connection is a significant part of the healing process. Is that always the case? Or is there going to, are there going to be certain circumstances where that connection is maybe detrimental in some way?
I was going to ask that too, because, you know, talking about empathy, it's easy to, as a ministry leader, to just say, okay, I'm going to pair you with this student who experienced something traumatic too. You guys just be friends. And there is a sense of comfort when you know that someone has experienced something similar to you. You don't have to explain everything. You don't have to ask permission to feel certain things. But can that be the grounds for like a toxic relationship? Is it like this self-loathing thing where it's like, woe is me? No, woe is me. And, you know.
Yeah.
I'm glad you asked that because I feel like in the classroom, I always saw the two kids who were closest to despair pairing up and talking about how difficult their life was. And it was like this despair cyclone that they somehow made things
worse. You don't want a despair cyclone.
For each other.
Not helpful. Yeah.
Fix that.
You're absolutely right, though. I mean, you can have it where they feel very comfortable. Like people who are in despair feel very comfortable around people who are in despair. And unhealthy thought processes will generally kind of attract unhealthy thought processes.
Right.
And that's the problem, though. What you're doing is you're having someone who's just connecting with you on the right side of your brain, but there's no shifting it into a logical process. So the problem is that if you just have emotional processing, sometimes instead of exhausting it, you're adding to it.
Okay.
Right? So you have somebody like, Yeah, I really feel like alone. You know, I feel really alone too. Yep. Yeah, I feel alone because I am alone. Yeah, I feel that way too because I'm alone.
That's an actual conversation I've heard between teenagers. Yeah,
that's our teenagers, right? Yeah, well, we're just alone. Nice. Right?
Yep.
And it's like,
that's
great. Great. Well, what have we solved right now? Right. We've added to our emotional pressure, right?
Yeah.
The problem is we're not actually dealing with it. We're not shifting it over to the logical side of the brain.
Okay.
That has to happen in order for despair to decrease. You have to think of despair as a dispairing, like the two sides of the brain are disconnected. Mm-hmm. And the only way to heal despair is to bring the two sides back together. But you can't do that just by going logical first. You have to first start emotional, then bring it logical.
That's good.
So it's not always best to put all the broken kids together. You know, everyone's broken, by the way, but you get my point.
Yeah.
To take all these like, oh yeah, this kid's been through something, that kid's been through something, let's put them together and let them talk about it. Yes, with guidance, right? Because at some point you want to lead them out of that. You want to say, tell me more. I feel alone. Why do you feel alone?
Right. So it's the despairing is the focus on one half of the brain, either half. Whether it's staying stuck in the emotional side or leading with the logical side. It's you've got to start with the emotional and then eventually lead into the logical.
So if you have a despairing of your brain and you just have all this emotional energy, then you're in despair. If you have a despairing of the brain and you have all this illogical processing and you're just ignoring the emotions, then you have a jerk. Right. And like you just you have emotional detachment.
Right.
And so neither one are good. Like healthy processing is being able to say, this is how I feel. And this is, you know, why I feel this way. And here's now what I believe about that.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, though, our emotions shape our beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And students are very quick, by the way, to say, oh, well, I feel this way. Therefore, I. This is what I believe, you know, I believe. I'll give you an example. So my 9-year-old isn't quite a teenager, but, you know, preteen-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he was getting in trouble for something. And I said, go to your room. And I started to close the door. And for whatever reason, just the heightency of this moment, he starts freaking out, like grabs my leg, starts acting like a toddler, really. And like, don't close the door, you know, and like heightened emotional response.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to do was kind of just shrug off and say, okay, he's just being over the top. He's trying to manipulate me, blah, blah, blah. But the more I tried to push against this, the more he became even more emotionally heightened.
Oh.
I finally stopped and I got down on the floor where he was, you know, holding onto my leg for dear life. And I said, what is going on? By the way, anytime you have something going on with a teenager and you start thinking, what is going on?
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with something that's not fully present.
Right.
Like you're dealing with something deeper.
An
you're dealing
issue.
With an underlying issue. And so here I was looking at my 9-year-old and I'm like, okay, what is going on? And I stopped and I looked him in the eye and I said, how do you feel right now? Like, what are you feeling? And he said, I feel scared.
Hmm.
Why do you feel scared? Now I'm mad, so I had to deal with my anger first, right? You know, be like, oh, I don't want to do this, but I know it's right. Why do you feel scared? And he starts to break down his emotion and he starts to express, I feel scared because when you close the door, I'm afraid you're going to send me off to another family. His core root issue was an abandonment issue. Where did that belief come from? How is it shaped? I don't know, but for whatever reason, that circumstance triggered him to a heightened emotional response. And then I was able to say that would never happen, right? I was able to logically, now he's exhausted the emotion. Then I was able to say that'll never happen. I was able to reinforce a better belief, which is I will, you know, you will always be a part of this family. And just because you're in trouble right now doesn't mean you're not going to be a part of this family. And then we were able to reroute the discipline to something that was more helpful and, constructive for him, which was, you know, I want you to write a letter because he was being disrespectful to somebody, you know. And so we were able to shift that, but that would have never happened if I would have just stuck to my guns of the principle. That would have never happened if I didn't notice the emotion and help him to exhaust the emotion first. And by the way, if you're listening to this podcast and you think I'm a messed up parent, it's because
we all are.
all messed up parents. And you're going to screw up your kids somehow. Just choose your way. I'm just kidding. But we're going to be imperfect, and we're going to be imperfect youth leaders. We're going to be imperfect youth pastors. Right. So this isn't about being perfect. This isn't about a formula.
Right.
This is about simply seeing people right where they are and helping them to navigate through tools that we know help the brain to heal.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, it's love.
Yeah.
It's empathy.
Yeah. That's good.
No wonder the Bible talks so much about it.
Wow. So one thing, I mean, if I could summarize what I hear you saying, two sides of the brain, emotional side, logical side. When the emotional side is heightened, we have to engage kids on the emotional side so that that emotion can drain out and we can engage them on the logical side.
Yeah.
I'm with you. That all sounds, and I think you might agree with this, that sounds like it's true for neurotypical kids. Mm-hmm. I can't help but think about a young lady who was at our church who had a traumatic brain injury that left the left side of her brain not working.
Wow.
So all she had was the one side. Now, if you know much about brain science, which obviously you do, parts of the brain will then begin to engage and become the logical side that weren't before, which is fascinating. God is weird in that way, and I love it. I think as leaders, we have to caution ourselves that not every kid is going to respond in this sort of neurotypical way.
Yeah.
And so getting to know parents and getting to like understand their academic situation, even when we can, being engaged in their special education programs might be helpful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the tools and the approach definitely changes based off of the circumstances and the individual, especially when you're facing pretty big obstacles like that, you know, that are not typical. The one thing that I think is the common thread, though, that I think we all would agree, is that love and human connection still matters.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, for sure.
Then if we stop and we look at an individual for who they are and we just listen long enough, like, I bet you we're going to find some solutions to just help that individual. And again, it won't be, whoop, we checked our box, we fixed the problem.
Right.
If we think we're going to fix the problems, we're kind of missing it.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, this is an exhausting career for people who feel like they need to fix it all.
Yeah.
Because it never happens quite the way that we want it to. But that doesn't mean that God can't be bigger than the mess, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
We see that. When we see amazing things that take place in the heart of these souls that God allows us and entrusts us to care for.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always make sense,
but
all I know at the end of the day is that love and empathy matter.
Yeah.
And it's the quickest way to connect with any kid, any parent, any human being, no matter who they are. And there are a lot of obstacles to your point, and the tools will definitely change. And we have to be wise to know when they change.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons I think you are a great leader. Because when I think about my early years in ministry, my temptation was to always say, well, just preach the gospel and the gospel will fix everything. And you're not saying don't.
Right.
You're saying there are some steps along the way to get a kid to a place where they can even hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is so powerful.
Well,
that's so good.
I've made a lot of mistakes. And I would agree, early on in my ministry career, it was, I'm going to preach the gospel.
Right.
I'm just going to tell them the truth. Well, this is what the book says.
Right.
I'm a man of the book, you know, you just want to like, this is we're this is truth. This is what we're going to do.
Right.
And I think over time I started to realize like, we're missing it. Like
I'm missing it.
I would say the problem of despair has also caused me to go deeper into this subject and really figure out, okay, how are we wired? How has God wired? How has God wired us? Because I don't believe he just left us here to just, well, good luck. Mm-hmm. I think we together are the solution. Like we are the body of Christ, that the solution is within us and it's together.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about collective togetherness that heals.
Yeah.
It heals us. Like our connection, with our Heavenly Father is very important.
Yeah.
But we often feel that connection through others, right?
Yeah.
You know, well, I really couldn't agree with you more. I feel like we are the body. And I keep asking myself, what does patience actually look like? What does, you know, love and empathy really look like when we just want to see our students grow? We just want to see them do well. We put all of this pressure on ourselves to solve their problems. Mm-hmm. But this is inspiring me because we're in it for the long haul. Mm-hmm. And it's the continual process of being there, showing up for them with empathy, allowing them to process maybe even the same emotions over and over, and us being willing to say, okay, well, I'm going to help you meet your emotion and then help you with scripture or however else process that.
Yeah.
That left side of the brain that that's despairing.
Yeah.
We're going to repair.
I like that. That's good. Guys, I'm so grateful for this conversation. And Will, thank you for bringing what you've learned this past year and a half to share with us. I think it'll help us a lot here at Orange as we move forward in our thinking and our strategy. And I think it'll be really helpful for a lot of the youth leaders listening and their experiences as well. And if you want to learn more about Will's organization, we'll have links in our show notes or head to willhudge.com. Thanks for listening and watching, and we'll see you next time.